Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Today, our guests include Dr. Rebecca Sadoun and Dr. Dima Cintron. Dr. Sadoun is an associate professor of adult and pediatric rheumatology at Duke University School of Medicine, where she serves as the program director for the Pediatric Rheumatology Fellowship and the Combined Med-Peds Rheumatology Fellowship. Dr. Sadoun was a 2018 recipient of the Rheumatology Research Foundation Clinical Scholar Educator Award, which funded her development of a curriculum to teach rheumatologists strategies for working effectively with adolescent and young adult patients and their families. She also leads a young adult rheumatology clinic at Duke, where she cares for patients who are transitioning out of pediatric rheumatology care into adult care models. Dr. Cintron is a combined internal medicine and pediatric physician, med-peds, who is currently pursuing a combined adult and pediatric rheumatology fellowship at Duke University. She completed her medical and med-peds residency training at the University of Puerto Rico Medical Sciences Campus and holds a master's in clinical and translational research from Mayo Clinic. As part of her clinical training, she takes care of adolescents and young adults with rheumatic conditions and has been involved in the transition to adult care for many of these young adults. She recently was the author of a review on transition to adult care, mentored by Dr. Rebecca Sadoun, that was tailored towards facilitating the care of childhood onset diseases for adult rheumatology providers. Ladies, welcome to SpondyCast.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Exactly. Thank you.
I'm so glad you're here, and we're going to talk today about transitioning to adult rheumatology care for young adults with spondyloarthritis. So let me ask you, what are the biggest differences between pediatric and adult rheumatology?
Great question. This is something we actually like to think and talk about a lot, since both of us are med-peds providers. We like talking and caring for young adults. And I think our healthcare system really is different between the two sides, and nobody tells people that. Mm-hmm. So we don't prepare people well enough for what to expect, and it can sometimes feel like a shock when they show up for their first visit on the adult side. Some of the differences are big, and some are more subtle. I think one of the things people notice first is just physical differences. So when you're seen in pediatrics, the walls are bright and colorful, the lighting is cheerful, there's other children, maybe games in the waiting room, and things just feel foreign. So the thing I hear the most from patients when they show up for the first time is like, it just feels strange. The walls are white and stark. I was sitting next to an 80-year-old in the waiting room, and it's just like a very palpable physical difference. What's interesting about young adults is sometimes both feel strange, right? It feels weird to have cartoon characters on the walls and to be sitting next to a crying baby on the pediatric side. And it feels equally awkward to be next to the 8-year-old on the adult side. I think that's just part of being a young adult, right? It's that time of transition. And sometimes they feel like they don't fit in either side. And the reality is, from our perspective, they fit on both sides. And it just takes a little getting used to. So I think that's the one that really strikes people the most when they make the transition. I'd say probably second, that they feel but don't always understand why, is the difference in the length of the clinic visit. So everybody knows what time their visit starts, like you have a 2:30 appointment, but what you may not know is you're actually slotted for a window. A 2:30 appointment may be 2:30 to 2:50. It may be a 30-minute window, 2:30 to 3, right? And there's another patient scheduled on the back end of that. So what I think that families notice a lot is it just feels faster than what they were used to. Sure. Because in pediatrics, kind of standard is something like a 30-minute visit. Sometimes it's even longer. And in the adult world, what's standard is 15 or 20-minute visits. So whereas you might have been used to a little bit more small talk or talking about how school's going, how work's going, all that kind mm-hmm. of stuff, sometimes there's less of that in the adult world.
A faster pace, which is sometimes, you know, sometimes you really are looking forward to your appointment with your pediatric provider, to just looking forward to telling them about how things are going in college or in school. And then it just seems a faster pace when they're in the adult setting.
And I think when people don't know that going in, they're like, what's with this adult doctor who doesn't even want to like get to know me, or like, why are they rushing? And they're not rushing. It's just a faster pace.
Right. It's a, why are we here conversation instead of a, how do we feel conversation?
Well, and the how do we feel sometimes important, and like, please bring it up, because if it matters and there's big things going on in their life, every adult doctor will make time and space for that. They may just not, you know, ask. They'll assume things are going well unless you raise the issue.
Right. And I've had a number of providers tell me that they'll put their hand on the door and then the real question comes So in the transition, some people find it challenging, like from a med side or different symptoms or comorbidities once you head into the adult side. What is that like?
Do you mind for just a second before we start with that one? Can I tell you just a couple more differences?
Sorry. You guys paused. I thought you were done.
Just because I do think the more people know these and anticipate them, the less they throw them off. So another big one is because the visits are a little faster paced, they tend to be more focused even on the physical exam. So in the pediatric world, we typically examine every single joint at every single visit and maybe measure the Schober's distance in the back at every single visit. And I think in the adult world, it tends to be more focused on like what your symptoms are. And if you say you're feeling and doing great, there may be very limited physical exam. And that does not mean that your adult doctor isn't thorough. That's just sort of more of the standard pace on the adult side. So if there is something bothering you, be sure to mention it. And if you do feel like there's a joint that needs to be examined, just raise that and the adult doctor would be happy to do that. I also think people sometimes notice that it can be harder to get in for urgent visits. There's just more patients. And so there's therefore kind of fewer slots. And so one of the other sides of the coin to that is really important not to miss a visit. So on the ped side, when you miss a visit, there's usually a greater opportunity to work you back in. And in fact, the pediatric office may even call and say, like, you missed a visit. You know, what happened? Can we help? How do we get you back in? And things just keep flowing on the adult side. So if you miss, nobody's likely to reach back out to you. And it's kind of the onus and responsibility on you to call the office and say, hey, I missed one and now I need to book a new one. And when that doesn't happen, sometimes we discover that somebody just doesn't show up for a year. They run out of their meds and then they don't think to call until there's a big flare. And maybe that could have been avoided if reaching out beforehand. So I always give young adults the advice, put the clinic appointment phone number in your phone. And if you ever have to cancel for any reason, I mean, life happens, things happen. You have a final exam, you get the flu and you may not always be able to make it. You get a flat tire. Don't call and cancel, always call and reschedule. Always have an appointment on the books. And that way you don't suddenly, oops, it's 2 years later and I'm flaring because I've been off meds for 2 years.
Right. Interesting. Okay. So let's go to some of the transition from pediatric to adult care and what is particularly challenging for young adults in terms of, is it having more meds, but maybe having other comorbidities or other symptoms pop up? Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think acknowledging that it's hard and telling our patients and their families to give themselves some grace. This is not going to be, you know, one day fix all. This will take time. And we know that, and they should know that. And our expectation is that together, you know, ideally over a couple of years, we'll get you to the point where you will be ready to transition to the adult setting and feel, you know, completely in control of your disease, like complete acknowledgement of your medications, and that will consistently change and be dynamic. So acknowledging that it will be hard and that is okay. I think a few challenges that our patients with spondyloarthritis should be aware of is that sometimes, and I was chatting with Rebecca earlier about this, when we diagnose a patient with spondyloarthritis, we usually diagnose them mid-adolescence, maybe peak 12 to 14 years old. And so we almost feel like that window of time where we make the diagnosis and we have to prepare them for the transition to adult care might be a little shorter than other of our rheumatic diseases, because we're diagnosing them and meeting them already in adolescence, where a bunch of other hormonal identity, you know, a lot of other transitions are happening. So we might have a shorter window to just diagnose the patient, treat the patient, and then eventually prepare them for that transfer. So that, I think, is one of the unique challenges that spondyloarthritis patients may face. In addition to that, you know, in addition to the diagnosis and medications, just navigating the healthcare system, finding that right adult provider, navigating when the right time will be to transfer or transition completely from the pediatric to the adult setting is also an important challenge. I don't know if there's any additional.
Absolutely. And I think coordination of care is just one of the things that she was talking about. So maybe there's uveitis and needing to see an ophthalmologist. And, you know, sometimes the pediatric provider can facilitate that on the pediatric side. And the adult side, again, we're kind of recognizing you're an adult. And so the onus is on the young adult and or their family to make those connections and to advocate for themselves. And if the rheumatologist said, I want to make sure you're seen by your ophthalmologist in a week, but they call to see the ophthalmologist and they're told, okay, next available appointment is in 2 months, that the patient or the family like tells that ophthalmologist, hey, the doctor said I need to be seen sooner. And if that doesn't do the trick, calls the rheumatologist and says, here's the problem. This is when I was given the appointment. Just kind of stepping up and learning that self-advocacy skill is super important for young adults.
Huge. Very, very big. Yeah. Not too teenagers.
I think it's not only hard to self-advocate for yourself. Sometimes if you have the burden of your, you know, new diagnosis, new medications, it's in itself hard to find the energy to advocate for yourself. So I think that's where the pediatrics specialist plays such a huge role. And then finding that ally on the adult setting to also start advocating for you. It's truly a team effort. We don't expect our patients or their families to do the transition by themselves. It truly takes a village.
Yeah. And I just think being patient with yourself, realizing it's like a muscle and you have to practice exercising it, right? And the first time you do it, it's hard and it gets easier and easier. And so the, you know, just push yourself more and more to try it out.
Yeah, it's definitely a skill, I think, when you, and I think too, the kids don't always know, and I speak from my own parenting experience, they don't always know when it's appropriate to take the appointment they were handed, just, you know, and when it's time to like raise the flare.
One of the most beautiful mind chart messages I've ever gotten was from one of my young adult patients who for a while did not advocate for herself and then just like stepped into that role and started owning it and reached out one time when she was transferring her infusions and was given an appointment like a week later than she would normally be scheduled for. And I was just so proud of her. She reached out to me. She was like, this is the date I was supposed to have it. This is the date they put it. So it's like 8 days late. Do you think that's safe? Like, do I need to call them back or is it okay? And I was like, oh, it's a perfect question.
That's a win. Right. No, I guess.
Yeah. She was doing great. 8 days was safe. But if she'd told me like 24 days, I would have said it was too long. And so, you know, like she asked. And that's the best thing you can do. Reach out to your provider and they'll let you know if you should be worried or if it's okay.
Right. And I always say, like, none of us know what we're doing half the time anyway. So just ask the question.
True that.
I think it's our experience that in some patients, we try it that first time and it goes forward smoothly. There's other times that we try and we're like, whoop, abort. Let's, you know, let's try that again. Let's, you know, regroup on the ped side again. Let's schedule that appointment again. Let's make sure you understand certain concepts and then try again. So it doesn't necessarily have to go smooth that first time around, but not losing focus that that's our goal long-term to get that transition to happen is also a reality that we face all the time.
And the advice I try to give pediatric providers is to plan this transition ahead of time. So kind of if it can be a countdown, hey, let's plan on you leaving in about 2 years. Okay, in about 18 months. Okay, that means we've got 3 visits between now and then. What do we need to get done between now and then? All right, you got 2 visits left. Okay, this is the last visit. And so it's not a surprise to anybody either. You're kind of like expecting it coming. And so that also means families to tell providers if you anticipate that coming in the near future. I'm going to be leaving for college, or I'm going to be leaving for grad school, or I'm going to be changing insurances, and that's the right time to transition so that we can all be on the same page and anticipating things. And it just goes better than when somebody says, oh, by the way, I need to switch to the adult side. It's the next visit. And then everything feels rushed and a little chaotic.
Right. Yeah. So at what age do they start to transition, Jim?
Yeah, that varies a lot. It varies by country. It varies by institution. It varies by provider, and it varies by family. So it, like in the, in Canada, it is at 18, right? You cannot be seen on the pediatric side the day you've had your 18th birthday. And it is very absolute. In the US, we have a lot more flexibility. And some providers will see patients sometimes through even mid-20s. The majority is probably early 20s. Many providers are willing to see patients through graduation from college. But it also may depend on the local area. Sometimes there's just not enough pediatric rheumatologists. And so there's so many people who need to be seen that they have to be a little bit stricter and say, like, at age 18, we have to make space for the three-year-old who can't be seen by the adult provider. And so they do it earlier. Just have that conversation, ask that question, kind of know what to expect, and then try to plan in advance of that.
Yeah. And so you were talking about the early prep, like super important for like winding down, I suppose, but it's really like the knowledge transfer, like it's graduation.
Yeah. And I mean, so the transfer, that final transition from the peds to the adult side, has kind of more that stringent timeline. But ultimately, you can start talking about this with families and patients since the age of 12, 14, you know, just mentioning the idea of the transition, start to assess where your patient's readiness for transition is. There's a questionnaire that we use. It has 20 items. It addresses multiple components that are important to the transition to adult care. So having that assessed since the age of 12, and then slowly dropping, you know, those little drops of knowledge, having patients gain some of those independent skills gradually, you know, something as early as 12 years can be part of your research.
And you said graduation, and I think that's one good analogy. The other analogy I love is driving, right? This is something that teens are always thinking about. So I think of transfer, like when you're actually moving to the other side, sort of like the day you get your license or the day somebody hands you car keys. But there's a lot behind that, right? You should never be just like jumping in a car and driving on your own the very first time you get in a car. You had to go to driver's ed, right? You had to practice behind the wheel. You had to learn the rules of the road. And all of that is the transition work that happens beforehand. And so I think about this also in terms of when somebody is going to graduate high school and head to college. If you know that you are leaving for college on like August 5th, you don't want to on August 4th start figuring out how to give yourself your own shots, or like, how do I fill out my pill box, or I don't know how to refill my meds at the pharmacy on my own. Those are things that you want to be practicing ideally, like at least a year in advance. It's just right. Like, you cannot learn to drive the night before your driver's test. You can't learn to do all the independent skills the day before you leave for college. And the more time you give yourself, the more it's like behind the wheel practice with somebody who knows how to do it sitting next to you. So you can troubleshoot, you can discover where the problems are. You can ask your parents, you know, for assistance, because there's somebody kind of looking over your shoulder helping out.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what do you see are the, like the most common challenges as they transition that sort of repeat themselves?
I think one we've highlighted a few times already, time, like let's not wait till the end. The earlier we start with the conversations, the more time we have to prepare you for that next step. So I think common mistakes is waiting too late to start talking about transition to adult care. We have to do that early and give ourselves enough time to introduce all these concepts and skills so patients are better prepared when the time comes.
The other two things I would highlight, one is it is really hard to prioritize your health when there's a lot of other things going on. And like young adulthood is a time of a lot of other things going on. You know, maybe you're moving into your first apartment on your own. Maybe you're going to college. Maybe you're having roommate trouble. Maybe you're like changing relationships. There's just like a lot. And sometimes health takes a back seat, especially if you're feeling well. Although we all know if you're feeling well and therefore not taking your medications, then there's going to come a time when you are going to feel poorly. And so we kind of see that cycle of like doing great, come off meds, flare, have to get back on a lot of stuff, feeling good, so stopping. And so just trying to not put it on the back burner and trying to stay on top of it and trying to stay consistent will facilitate the rest of your life going better, because you don't have those flares that interrupt things. So that's one big one. And the other thing I was going to say is, now I don't remember what the other thing I was going to say is.
I think a common pitfall is that sometimes patients don't feel comfortable telling us about the transition. I mean, pediatricians, we're nosy. We want to know what's going on. So if there's a big transition, you know, you're doing a trip abroad and you're going to be abroad a few months because of high school or college, or, you know, you're moving to a different state or just transitioning different colleges, campus, knowing that ahead of time gives us the opportunity to, again, introduce the concepts, work around the dynamics of providers and adult and pediatric settings. So I think that's a common pitfall that we see.
Totally. I remembered the other. So the second challenge, I think, is when people think of different as worse. So there's what you're used to in pediatrics. That's your norm. Like, you're working with one person and you learn the way they do things, and there's medicines that they like and ways they like to do it. And you're like, all right, things are good and that's right. And then somebody does something a little different when you switch to the adult side. A different doesn't mean worse. It's just different. So give yourself time to get used to the way they do things. In fact, sometimes it's improved. Sometimes now that you're on the adult side, there's new medications that you qualify for that may be even better at controlling your disease. So just give it time. I mean, if you have a specific concern, like, hey, I already tried that medicine, it didn't work for me, share that, right? That's great. But if you haven't tried that medicine, maybe actually it will be the breakthrough for you. Just being open to the fact that things may be different, and that's okay.
And just out of curiosity, how often does someone sort of circle back to you to ask questions about, like, I'm not really sure about?
Yeah, I wish way more often. What I find is they go to the adult side, they feel like the door is closed on the pediatric side, they hear something new that scares them, they think that was weird, and they just don't go back to the adult provider, but they'd also don't go back to the pediatric provider. And then things fester until it kind of blows up. Yes, as a pediatric provider, I'd be more than happy to, like, hear the adult plan and give it a thumbs up and be like, absolutely, that makes perfect sense. In fact, if I could have accessed that medicine, I would have. I love that idea.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I'm guessing there's sometimes you were talking about even just the vibe of the offices are different, and a lot of, I'm sure the adult doctors, the rapport isn't there from day one.
And sometimes, you know, something that we commonly hear is that dynamics with parents, for example, and our privacy policies in the adult setting and how we disclose information regarding our young adults, well, that also changes. And if our teenager is going to, or a young adult is going to allow parents to get information about his healthcare, that there has to be a document that's signed in our office. So definitely that dynamics is different, and that can be scary. And like Rebecca said, some patients just, you know, take a step back and not hearing back from their pediatrician or not reaching out to them also has the consequences that about 0.5% of patients with rheumatic disease don't get adequate care during that first year of the transition.
Yeah, half of patients, 50%. Yeah,
50%, which, yeah, I think is a scary number. It's half of our patients, when they're doing that first transition, don't necessarily get adequate care.
So half of the patients, so 50%, don't even show up for the first visit.
Yeah.
Like, that's a barrier. And of those who do show up, half don't continue to follow up, like kind of have a first visit, say this feels weird,
wow,
and not come back. Yeah, so it's the minority that kind of push through and have a smooth process. And I usually say, like, give it a try, give them a couple of visits, because the other thing people forget is that, you know, if you've seen your pediatric provider a dozen times, and sometimes it's even more than that, right? Sometimes it's for a decade.
Yeah.
That is like a familiar, comfortable, like, intimate relationship. You guys know each other super well.
Yeah.
You go for a very first visit with anybody. I mean, and it could have been a different pediatric provider if you moved states, but that first visit, it can't feel as familiar or comfortable, right? It's like a first date. It's a little awkward.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it's got to be like a breakup or something.
Yeah, exactly. And you're like, oh, I don't feel as connected to this person. And then you turn that into, so they're not somebody I'll ever feel comfortable with, or they're not the right doctor for me. You can see how you never give somebody a chance. So I always say, yeah, at least 3 visits, give them a real chance. And you may discover that, yeah, as you're following up and getting to know each other, it starts to go better.
Can I ask you a question on the spot? Do you have that rate of fall off? Because I would imagine yours would be less.
Yeah, this has even been studied at Duke, you know, at our institution. It is, or at least had been before we started working on it, the exact same. It's been studied in a bunch of different diseases. So it was true for sickle cell patients in hematology. It's true for congenital heart disease. It's pretty true across the board. And it's true in different healthcare settings. That's kind of like the natural state of things. Mm-hmm. And we've definitely developed some, you know, transition clinics and, you know, worked to warn patients about these changes and, you know, give people a chance. And I like to think that we're moving the needle, we're changing those numbers locally. But this is sort of the like inherent thing that we're all up against. And we kind of all need to fight to make it better.
Yeah. Well, and I was reading this morning an NIH paper on non-compliance in general and like root cause. I didn't finish it. So I don't know the punchline of what this leads to. But I was reading it this morning and it said, you know, that there's such a high number of, I think there's a new word for it. I don't want to call it non-compliance. It's like
non-adherence. Yes.
Yeah, non-adherence. And yeah, I imagine. And I try to think of like my kids and where you have to prompt them to like get to the right places. And we keep it all on the family calendar. And it's like, don't forget you know, good morning. Don't forget you have a doctor's appointment today. And those things. But I think there's also parents not being aware creates mm-hmm. an issue. In the back of my head, I have this idea that like when kids go off to school, that you could find a way to like on their registration forms, have it alert everyone in their medical community that says that their parents can still get information and get all the documents signed up front. So do you think that some of this is, you know, stress, like just managing practical aspects of the transfer?
Yeah, I think during our adolescence and young adult years, there's just a lot of transitions happening. You're wrapping up high school, you're deciding what your next steps are going to be, either college, starting a new job, you're either staying within your household with your family or transitioning to a roommate setting. So I think there's a lot of changes happening. And within those changes, you're finding your identity, you're truly kind of defining what your next steps, what your goals are going to be. And then to add to that, you have a chronic disease, you have all these medications that you have to take, you have to have that routine within all these transitions that are happening. So I think it's just part of all these changes happening that really speaks to having that 50% of patients not following up after that first visit. Yeah. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, tons. Yeah, and you have written a book on change management, essentially, right?
Oh my goodness.
So from the continuity of care, once they get in there, do they stick around that 25%?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different trajectories. So some people make the transfer, and then have no blips and no problems, and it's, you know, smooth as can be. And then some go for a couple of visits and all is well, and then either life happens and gets in the way, or they feel so good that, you know, all of our brains are always trying to tell us, I don't have this disease, I'm fine, I've gotten over it, right? Nobody yeah. wants to have a diagnosis. And so it is very easy to fall into that mental trap of like, I felt great for like a year, this was a thing of the past, and then stop going and, you know, come off meds and have a flare. And we get that. I also think that there's some patients who then they don't want to come back because they're afraid that their doctor's going to be mad at them or yell at them, what happened? Why didn't you show up to your last appointment? And especially people who work with young adults get it. Mm-hmm. That's like normal, no problem. We turn a new leaf, give us a call, get back in. Let's just get you back into care and get you feeling better.
Yeah, no, I like that. And we tend in our family, my kids get a lecture or a reminder every 6 or 12 months that if you are the child of someone with spondyloarthritis, that taking your fish oil and your vitamin D and doing your things, actually, right? The research shows that you're going to have a hopefully a better outcome. And that always like, then all of a sudden I see fish oil on the curb, like that. I get a fish oil receipt. So the compliance is hard. And I think it becomes habitual, I hope, for a lot of these kids. Okay, so support groups or mentorship, how do you see that as a valuable tool in the toolbox?
I think it's super valuable. And I think it also particularly helps with sort of acceptance of having a chronic disease. Like I said, people's brains want to tell them that they don't have it anymore. And if you don't take your medicine, then you can kind of more readily ignore that you have a disease. And knowing somebody else who has it just normalizes it. So it's fantastic, particularly if you can get to know people who are a similar age or a little older who have your exact condition. So, you know, having a spondy buddy is phenomenal, and seeing how they've been able to live their full life, adapt and just thrive despite it, I really think is extremely motivating. But even if it is not somebody who has your exact same condition or is in a similar circumstance in life, just recognizing that everybody's got something. You know, you got one friend who's got diabetes and another who's got asthma and another who's got sickle cell, and like everybody's got something. Yeah. And like we all need to access healthcare for it, and we all need to take medicines. And the more we can normalize that, the easier it is for teens and young adults and really anybody.
Yeah, I think peers. Mm-hmm. So that's like an accountability buddy that we always chat about. And then a mentor is kind of, if you meet someone who is maybe a little ahead of you, has already used the same medications, or have reached disease remission for multiple years, that just truly becomes a mentor, someone to look up to. So I think it also depends on the patient, when the patient is ready to reach out to those support groups. I think sometimes patients need to really process the diagnosis before reaching out to support groups. I don't know what your experience was, Jill. I've had some patients who feel like it's too much. They go online and they read too many experiences that are very different, maybe a little scary for them. So it truly takes some time for them to be ready to reach out to those resources.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think it is hard to reach out for the resources. I know, I mean, in my own experience, it was having had symptoms for a long time and then being diagnosed. And I struggled. I mean, I felt right, because then you go, oh, half the battle, kind of sometimes knowing is half the battle. But then dealing with this, what happens to my life? And I have two toddlers, and all of a sudden you're not sure what to do, and you are spinning and Googling, and right, 10, 12 years ago, it wasn't as available. But I was spinning a bit with it. And right prior, I was like a teenager. I was like 70% travel, always on the go. And my doctor finally said to me, I really think you should investigate a support group through Spondylitis Association. And then I did, and I was like, oh, this is great. I love it. Like, how can I do one? And so it really, it took a prompting from someone, because I also think we have a lot of, you know, the awareness of the disease, despite its prevalence, is still low. Mm-hmm. So how do we, and I would ask, right, how do we, as people with the disease or related to the disease, how do we continue to amplify it so that people do know there are resources out there, right? Like, I think we've got 70 support groups, and most of them are online now. I don't know if there are specific PEDS ones. But yeah, I mean, I think some of it is awareness, and you feel lost not realizing there's three million people who share the same feelings of fatigue or whatever it is that you have.
Yeah, that's so true. Can I ask, since you have been able to access that resource, what kind of a difference did it make in your life?
So for me, going to the support groups, I mean, I felt like there was a community. I did know one other person with spondylitis, but I didn't know what it was called. But for me, I felt like someone actually understood. And I think a lot of us who are diagnosed with this disease go through a period, right? We don't end up at the rheumatologist frequently because we're feeling great. And it's usually a multi-year adventure, we'll say, by the time you get there. But when you do get there, it's it's scary, right? I mean, just like you have, the kids have trouble transitioning to a new relationship. I mean, having a chronic disease is like having a different, it's like having a relationship with a different part of yourself that you never knew. So I found meeting people who also had the disease and moms and, you know, other people in similar situations. I also found out that it wasn't like the end of my life, and that that was part of the reason I wanted to be a support group leader, was to give back on when I was feeling better, and to share with people or just be there or listen. I'm always talking too much, so but I try to listen, but just to be there. And there's a number of people, I don't go to support group meetings anymore. I keep an eye on them, but there's a number of people who now just are in my circle of trust that when I'm not feeling good or they're not feeling good, they reach out. And, and of course, right, with the, you know, just being so involved with SAA, I'm around it almost every day, at some point in my day. But it really became an acceptance piece for me. And it's why I wanted to join the board and be part of getting us to the point where we really like blow the lid off this disease for the world. So, yeah. So
empowering.
Yeah. So I highly recommend it. Okay. So on that note, we're going to land here for our part one of our part two. So I want to thank you for joining us. And any words of wisdom to wrap our first half?
I would say give yourself some grace. That's what I think I tell my patients all the time, my teenagers and young adults, give yourself some grace. We're going to work through this and we're going to get you to the point where you're going to go to the adult world and you're going to rock it.
Yeah. And it can be bumpy, right? Like buckle up your seatbelts. It's not like always perfectly smooth. Right. There can be turbulence, two steps forward, one step back. Don't get discouraged by the step back. You know, every 30-year-old is more mature in handling it better than they were when they were 25. And every 25-year-old is handling it better than when they were 20. Every 20-year-old is handling it better than when they were young. Just realize you are moving forward and just keep trying your best and keep reaching out for help and make it a team. You and your rheumatologist and other members of your medical care are your team, and use us that way.
I love it. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you soon.
Sounds great. Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie.
Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit, educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.